Just to review, a little bit of review of our first conference. We're praying in Advent to be people who are freer to receive and then distribute, then share as instruments of grace. We are also praying in Advent to take back the sacramentals of Advent and Christmas from the strict secular possession of them. And we spoke of sacraments in our homes. And then, of course, the ultimate thing is that Jesus was the prime sacrament, making his disciples and wanting to make all people sacraments. That in a sense, there are seven sacraments in the Catholic Church, and then there are eight. And the eight is the body in toto and in particular. That each of us is sacramentalized to be an encounter place, an outward sign blessed by Christ to be a grace. And by grace, I mean the love of God moving not towards strict forgiveness, not just mercy, but the continuing of God's creation of this world. And we are responsible, I think, to be creative of each other's person, to become more and more who you are. And that the nature of love, and that which what Jesus did most was go around and give people themselves. Just like parents want to give children life, but then give them who they really are. Give them their ethnic background, but awareness of their gifts and their dignity and their powers. Well, that's what love does. Love, I want to give you you. I don't want to just give you me, but I want to give you you, and that because it's in the nature of gift, I can't give what I don't know, I can't give what I don't like, I can't give what I don't have. Those are things. I have to know it, I have to like it. You don't give something away that you don't like. You throw it away if you don't like it, but you don't give it away. So I have to know myself, have myself, and love myself in order to give myself away. Who's going to help me know and accept and love myself? It's my family, my spouse, my parents, my siblings, my community members, that are the continuing of God's creative grace in my life. And then I become part of God's creation of everyone I meet. At least I want to be. That's my orientation. And that's what Jesus came to do. So where do we go now? We talked about sacraments last night as those things around our house that people on our fingers or our wrists or that something is being said in those gifts. And then when I receive them again, even though they were originally given to me 40 years ago, I receive them again, maybe even more deeply now than I did then. But we're going to pray now with certain Advent and Christmas secular symbols that you cannot avoid. They're there, and you might ask people, what do you think that is about? What do you think, for instance, the Christmas tree is about? And they say, oh, it's about family. Well, that's right, in a sense. But might there be something even more behind it that we may have forgotten? And so if you forget what it's about, then you make up your own, which we do, you know. So in our country, we just recently celebrated Thanksgiving. Our secular culture says, no, the Thanksgiving Day is to thank other people. You thank customers, you thank family members, community members. You send Thanksgiving cards around because you're thankful to people. But George Washington, who initiated 1789, let's have a day set aside for thanking God for our country, and Abraham Lincoln making an official holiday. Said, let's thank God. So the secular, we don't like that. Our whole nation doesn't like to give thanks to God because there are people who don't believe in God and we don't want to offend them, so we let them offend us. Anyway. But then why have turkey? Well, because there's a lot of them around and they're a reminder of our relatives. So, our history would say that the people had native fowl, turkeys and partridges, so that became kind of a Thanksgiving thing. But you can forget the meaning of a symbol and make your own. And we love to do that. And I believe the secular world, the commercial world, has done that. And we as people of faith and people of liturgy and community, we would like to regain them. And that's what this day is really about. So let's take a couple just to pray with. And my hope is, and I want to say it again, I'm not against family Christmas. I'm not against Santa Claus, Easter bunnies. I'm not against all that. I'm not Ebenezer squared. I enjoy Christmas and mistletoe and things. But let's take, how would you pray? What would be the prayer of the Christmas tree? Well, we have to go back to why did they put the birth of Jesus on the 25th of December? Well, you say, well, because incarnation, the Annunciation, is on the 25th of March. And Mary was extremely regular, and so nine months to the day. Well, that's not that at all. So we got to put that aside. And as you are aware, we're dealing with a northern hemisphere symbolism here. And if you've been in Central America or South America or Africa, the southern climes, New Zealand, Australia, the symbols, in a sense, don't work real well because the whole experience is around the winter solstice, so that the sun, which at its zenith is almost going straight down, as it's going to the south because of the tilting of the earth, it looks like, to the prehistoric people, to what we call pagans, but to pre-Christian tribes and things, that the sun is going out of existence. Well, what would happen if the sun were to go out of existence? That life would go out of existence, especially because the fields, the agriculture, see, everything was agriculture. There was no factories and all that. Everything was sustenance, sustaining life. So you ate what you could grow. Well, if the sun doesn't shine and the rains don't come, we'll die. So it almost looks like the sun is going out of existence, and then it starts coming back. And that's the solstice. So that there was the festival of the Sol Invictus. It's Invictus would be the fourth principal part, passive, having been not conquered. So victus would be, had been conquered. Invictus, not conquered. The festival of the sun that has not been conquered. It's coming back, and guess what? If the sun comes back, then life is coming back, and light is coming back, and fruitfulness is coming back, and we're going to live. Remember those things. Light, fruitfulness, life. Because the Christian community, under suspicion and confinement and persecution, says that is a perfect time to bring about our celebration of something Christian. Well, Easter was obviously the only real celebration. The resurrection of the crucified Christ. That is still, religiously, our major feast. Secularly, not so. But our major feast is not Christmas. Our major feast is the resurrection of Jesus. So that why raise in the history of the church, why raise the nativity of Jesus to an important celebration and reminder? Well, it's this. Because by the beginning of the 4th century in the history of the church, there were many different ways of looking at Jesus. Well-intentioned, struggling with, obviously, how much divinity and how much humanity did Jesus have? Was he half and half? Was he more this or more that? And different people, in well-intentioned and good theologians, saying, Jesus was really human, but only appeared divine, or he was really divine and just appeared human. And many people, and some of in this room, probably suffer from that same heresy. And we do. It goes back and forth because we can't get in our minds the mystery of one person with two natures. A divine nature and a human nature interacting with each other totally. Now that's what we believe. Now, there are people who struggle with that even today. In not just theologically, but relationally. That Jesus in the scriptures can appear at times not to be fully human. That he because of the writings of the Gospels, it can appear that Jesus really knew the future. And there are people, and I've talked to some, who really believe that Jesus, lying in the manger, knew that the shepherds were coming. And that he really was kind of a baby. Well, there's a problem with that. And the problem is that Jesus then, as divine, asks us to follow him as human. That he really didn't walk the walk. So we're following. And he picked up his cross, but it was light because he was God. And says, now you pick up your cross, but it's heavy because you're human. No, that his acts of faith in his God was just like ours. The humanity of Jesus allowed him to in an agonizing way fulfill his mission and ministry in person. He did not pick up the cross and saying, oh, I'm another day closer to resurrection and I'll be out of here in no time. No, there are people who really believe that. And sincerely and prayerfully. But the teachings, remember I said that we have to live with the tensions of our beliefs. That the crosses we lift and live with, the ambiguities and the fears and the doubts, those were part of Jesus' humanity too. So, I digress a little bit, but by the 4th century, early 300s, what do we have to do? We have to counteract the over-divinization of Jesus. So one of the best ways, the way, was let's emphasize a Mass in celebration of his humanity, which would be his birth. That he was born of woman, and her call to trust was a human experience. And the humanity of Jesus coming into this world, as I said last night, he came to us according to us. So he's got to come. If love is real, then love adapts to the beloved. Love wants to be where the beloved is most, him or herself, and wants to come to them according to them, their ways of receiving. And our way of receiving is person to person, is sensible. That is, we sense it, we hear it and see it and can touch it. So the rise of the festival, of the celebration, was very quiet. Constantine, in the 325, made it more of a national kind of thing. That it's going to be a permanent time of reflecting that the incarnate Word of God, Jesus Christ, was human. That's a big thing. So what we're celebrating at Christmas, what we're praying to receive, is Christ's divinity joining Christ's humanity in a tremendous mystery that we ponder and wrestle with, and we come down on different sides. Even in your own reflection, your own prayer, sometimes you would experience Jesus as more transcendent, more out there, and then people will talk about Jesus as my buddy or my friend, then emphasizing more the humanity. It's very difficult to keep it in balance in our prayer and in our reading of the Gospels. Well, that being said, let's talk about Christmas tree, which is a great symbol. Roy mentioned Christmas Stories of My House. Being from Milwaukee in Wisconsin, which is a state here in the United States that has many trees, as the northern part of our country does, my father would get a Christmas tree that was not pyramidic. It was more like a number 10 can. It had to be as wide at the top as the bottom. And so it had a crew cut up against the ceiling. And the top of the tree was then preserved for the dining room. And so we had two trees. And it was no small tree. It had to be as big as my father's desire to have Christmas and family. Was a tremendous desire in him. So it had this huge tree. Now what do you have to do before you bring a tree into your house? Okay? What's that?
Cut off the
bottom. You have to cut the bottom off so it get, that's right. And in some families you have to cut off the top to get it in the house. But you do have to move the furniture. And that's my first kneeling place today. That is not just a something to be done quickly. Now you got to get what's going to be going on in these presentations is how did do the things of Advent, but there's a prayer behind them. So a tree comes into your house. I move that over there. Get the TV over there. Move the lamp there, and we'll put it here. We put it over there last year. That didn't work. Put it over here. Yeah, we got that done. Now bring the tree in, get the vacuum cleaner out, and let's get this whole thing done. Well, I think we're missing a tremendous opportunity to pray. And so, what's the prayer of the tree in the house? What was going on in the Roman, Italian, the Roman Empire, Italy and into the Mediterranean and up through Germany and Belgium and France and England, was that the solstice was the beginning time of hope, because there was going to be fruitfulness. So that the people of that time, the non-Christians we'll call them, were decorating their tree with the fruitfulness that was hoped for, so that they would save, as we do at Thanksgiving, you might decorate your house with pumpkins and squash and rutabagas. Some people don't like. But the fruitfulness of the past, let's tie them onto to the dead trees, the trees that appear to be dead. Their leaves are gone, the fruit is gone. Let's tie them on and dance around them, because the sun has not died, the sun is coming back, and we will have planting time, fertility, production, and we will stay alive. So that the sun will keep the plants alive and the plants will keep us alive. That's a time of rejoicing. Okay? So what the Christians did was they did the same thing, but with a different spirituality, a different prayer of it. And that's what I think we can come back to. We don't have to let that go only to the secular Christmas trees are for the nice smell, and we gather around the Christmas tree and we sing O Tannenbaum and we light it up so that other people see it. No, there's a prayer there. And I'm not making this up. It's not just some kind of poetic something. This is the realness of it. This is what our Christian ancestors did. So they would bring the tree into the house with something decorating on it. And because they were Christians, they were also of that secular culture that was celebrating it for the fruitfulness of the earth. The Christians could do the same. But there was a spirituality behind that. So you have, in our cultures, in North America, you bring a dead tree into a warm house, which is a strange thing, to bring a huge tree into a small house. Which is to say, the tree which was outside now is inside. Divinity, which was outside, now has come inside. Okay? So that the tree itself is the symbol of the humanity, divinity of Jesus. That the divinity and the humanity have joined. That's why I think, that's how I pray, with the reality of a dead tree in a living house. That the tree represents the risen Jesus, the divinity of Jesus coming into the human experience. Does that make sense to you? And you got to pray with that. You know, even when looking for a Christmas tree. But here is the fun part. It's the rearranging of furniture, because that's exactly what Jesus did and does. In Scripture, Jesus keeps rearranging our furniture. And one of the ways to see it is to go into Scripture and see in whose lives did Jesus rearrange the furniture. Did the divinity, total divinity and total humanity of Jesus, come into people's lives and rearrange the furniture? Well, like what? Who? I would... yes? Apostles. Certainly the apostles. No more boat building, net mending, fish hooking. It's different now. And Jesus says, I will make you a different kind of fisher person. You will no longer collect taxes. You will collect souls. Zacchaeus, you don't belong in the tree. You come down here and in a very incarnate phrase, using the same phrase in Luke's gospel that the angels use, because I want to stay at your house today. And he welcomes him joyfully. Those words echoing the angels' news of great joy, come to the house, those things that Jesus is rearranging, certainly in the life of our Blessed Mother, rearranging furniture. So what I'm proposing is that when you're rearranging furniture, plan it and sit there and say, this is what the tree does in our house temporarily. And then reflect and pray with that Jesus has in Scripture rearranged the furniture in some people's lives. And most people. And the people whom he invited to a rearranged life, those whom he failed to rearrange, we are part of them too. That the rich young man and the scribes and the Pharisees and different people rejected him because they didn't want the rearrangement. In the first letter of Screwtape, if you've read Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis, where the uncle devil is writing to the nephew devil, and it's very interesting. It's if you're interested at all about the possibility of being seduced by other spirits than grace, the Screwtape Letters are a great way. But he says in the first one, he admonishes his nephew, who is trying to attract the client. He talks about the client. He says, keep impressing upon them the absolute necessity of the familiar. Okay, and we all know that. We love the familiar. And to go into the adventure of the new, if you've read The Hobbit by Tolkien. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were great friends and discussed often. But at the beginning of The Hobbit, when Gandalf and his companions show up, and Hobbit lets them into his hobbit hole, and they just ransack the place and eat everything and sleep everywhere. And the Hobbit, Gandalf, the next morning, Bilbo Baggins, the Hobbit, is sitting out on his front little earth smoking his pipe, and he said, "We would like to invite you to an adventure." And Bilbo says, "No, we don't do adventures today. We don't. But he goes. The adventure is what our life of faith is. But we are always attracted to the familiar, and so to have our furniture rearranged is difficult. To have our ways challenged by anybody is very difficult. And yet the call of Jesus is, as I've been saying, in Advent we are praying to receive what he wants. Jesus came is to be receptive to the adventure and the rearrangement of the familiar. But we don't like that. We don't like to do adventure. We don't like to let go of the familiar. To go into the adventure of the unknown is very frightening for us, for some more than others. But we all have the convenience and the ease and the, in a sense, we like the non-reflectiveness. In the familiar asks us not to reflect much. But it's when you're lost. Do you know that when you're physically lost is when you're more likely to be attentive? Well, we would like to be more attentive in the familiar. Yes, well, that's a function of spirituality too, to be attentive, to be aware, to go a little deeper with the familiar. But it's very difficult. So that to have to go into the adventure, into the unknown, is a graceful place. And so Jesus kept calling people to the unknown and rearranging. One of the rearrangements in Jesus is that he asked Peter to put aside his global positioning system. Because Peter had one and he knew where all the fish were biting out on the lake. And Jesus says, no, you can't take that with you. And he said, well, how are we going to know where we're going? And Jesus says, yes. Well, yes what? Yes, come follow me and learn what yes means. Well, we don't like that. Couldn't we just have a good talk here in my boat? And I will be able to tell you where you can catch fish. And I will be able even to tell you when storms are coming. Jesus says, just come follow me without the security of the familiar. And I will make you not only a fisher, but I will make you deeper. You will be deep sea, deep seeing. And you will become more aware, not only of what's around you, but what surrounds you. My care for you, which you will have to rely on more than your global positioning system. Well, that's not so easy. To trust, it's very difficult for people with whom I'm driving to trust that I know the directions. And I'll say, well, it's two blocks down here. You take a right. On the left, you see a Walgreens. And then they pull over and look at a map. And I say, well, I really understand what you're doing. It's very difficult for us to trust. Relationally, we want to relate factually and evidence that we can touch. Well, that's part of this movement of the tree into your house. And to, if you understand a little bit what I'm trying to say, is then when you're getting a place ready for the tree, you might have to take some of the furniture out. You might have to let go of certain lamps, couches, tables, entertainment centers, whatever. And you say, I don't know how we're going to get along without that. You know, where is that going to go? And will it get damaged? And I'll have to go way over there. I might have to get along without it to have a Christmas tree. So some people can be very upset at the tree. And so we want, could we just get a little table model that doesn't rearrange the... No, let there be lots of rearranging for Advent. And pray with it. And read scripture about Abraham and Moses and Jeremiah and Mary and Peter and Paul. Read about the rearranging of getting knocked off your comfortable horse. And struck with blindness, and then hear God say, "I'm calling you, Paul." There's Christianity is definitely a religion of rearrangement. Jesus, that's what Jesus did. He was rearranging the religious experiences. Not only do you have to go to the temple, but you have to let the temple come to you. I want to stay at your house today. I want to eat with you, Simon the Pharisee. I want to touch you, leper. There's a rearranging of the image of God, you see. And if you rearrange the image of God in your life, you definitely will rearrange life. And that's what conversion is about and relationship is about. That we don't confine God to judge or doctor, that God is infinitely other. We have to have images, but to let God be surprising, to let God be Gandalf and invite us to adventure, and we will be sit there with our Bilbo pipe and say, we don't do adventure today. And we all experience that. There's many days that I just would like to just stay here in the lazy boy experience of life. Okay, so that's, to me, that is a wonderful beginning now of Advent to what to do with the tree, because the tree becomes, as a symbol of Christ, a tremendous experience because it penetrates the whole house, the smell of it, and the size of it. And if you have, say, a dog in your house, he knows what trees are about. And he or she knows. And we had a dachshund dog that was very intelligent. This dog, Nick, the dachshund, was actually part human. He would go upstairs sideways and check out if anybody had left their electric blanket on, and then snuggle down underneath there, only letting his little nose out. Well, he didn't understand this tree, but he saw something to nibble at, and so he pulled the whole tree over on him. That was Nick, the Christmas of Nick, the dog. So after that, the rearrangement was we also had to tie the tree to the wall. But there's no spirituality there, I don't think. But more about the tree. Now let's decorate the tree. And I would say, now this, you got to remember that I am a devout celibate. I don't have children, though I'm the superior of a community in which there are boys. Lovely boys. And they love decorating and celebrating. And so we do it, and I love it. But I think there is a way that we can Advent with decorating the Christmas tree. And it would be this. Now, 98% of people cannot do what I'm asking, but it's just a way of looking at things differently. I am rearranging your Advent experience. What would happen if you rearranged the furniture and then brought in the tree, set it up, and just let it stand there absolutely bare naked? Well, the neighbors might call 911 and say there's something wrong over there, because that tree has been standing there for a couple days. What goes on when you bring a tree in from the cold is that the raised and uptight arms start coming down. You can pray with that. Because the arms, not only of Jesus, melted our image of God's arms, that God's arms are outstretched to us, but then we are to begin something about arms that I'll come now to. That as you decorate the tree, and what would happen if you would decorate the tree prayerfully a few at a time? We have Advent candles that increase light, and we'll talk about them. We have Advent calendars that you punch out a little window every... Do you have those? Yeah. What would happen if you decorate it a little at a time? Maybe, I know you have to put the lights on first. Could you experience that the lights don't work more patiently? That'd be a rearrangement, all right. And that they're all tangled up. And who did this anyway last year? And then we have to go down to the store and get blah, blah, blah. But that would be a rearrangement. But then to little by little decorate the tree. Because the ornaments are very important. And the lights are very important. Because real ornaments are fruit-shaped. So they're global and they're elongated like bananas or pomegranates. Why? Because the tree was a promise of fruitfulness. And the lights are also, colored lights are all about fruitfulness, apples and oranges and rutabagas. And all the fruitfulness of the earth that was a promise of fertility and life, that we were going to live, and the earth was going to be good to us again because of the sun. And the trees become a symbol of fertility, and the ornaments become the product of fertility. What would happen if we were to pray with those going on more slowly than just, let's get that done, been there, done that, Christmas tree done, that's one more thing off the Advent list. But to have you individually or your family pray with what's going on. What do those ornaments and lights mean? See, what we're doing, we're taking it back from how the secular stole it away from us. It's not just the Grinch that stole Christmas. It's our forgetfulness of what it's all about. And so we have to default to something else. I lived in a house in Toronto, Canada. And this other Jesuit, in fact, some of you know Father Klimchek, Father Leon. He and I made, we made a fruitcake. And it weighed 32 pounds. If you know Father Klimchek, that's reasonable. But we put it in those spring pans, and they were a smaller and then a larger and then a real big one, and then we made cookies, and we froze the cookies because, and this was during Advent, we froze the cookies because they're going to be for Christmas, and we put the fruitcake away, all wrapped in brandy-soaked cheesecloth, And we're going to have some of that today. This was 28 years ago, but it's still here. But we put the cookies in the freezer because to save our brothers from themselves. You see, because they'd eat them and have Christmas too early. And we were known as the Grinch that froze Christmas. And we still are. But to come to the awareness of what is the tree about and what are the ornaments about, it's then that you pray that this is a pledge of our being the fruitfulness of the fertility of grace. The fertility that is Jesus. The openness to life that Jesus impregnates us with. We, because of the birth of Christ, because of the coming of the divine into the human, because of the Christmas tree, we will be the ornaments. And so some families each year, each person of the family has a new ornament to put on a tree. That's their ornament. And maybe their name is on it. But every year, the ornaments of their past are up there. Little ones and big ones. But it's a pledge, not that we're family. That's too secular. But that we pledge that we are the fruitfulness of Christ. What is that? That we are the sacraments. That we are the blessing. We are the encounter place now. I live no longer I, but Jesus Christ lives in me. I am I am the temple. I am the holy place. I accept that. That's part of what I receive by celebrating Christ's nativity, incarnation, coming, enfleshment. I pledge myself that I would want to be a light, a joy, a reminder, a sacrament, a reflection, a memory. My father, this great man, when having recovered from alcohol, took a job at Evinrude Outboard Motors, a company in my hometown of Milwaukee, and we didn't have much, and he brought home, if you know, if you're familiar with carpentry, the wood shavings, those little spiral things, he would bring home silvery blue metal ones. Those are still on our tree because they're a reminder of resurrection. They are a reminder of growth and sacramentality and goodness. So it doesn't have to look like fruit, but it can be a sacramental reminder. And so you will have those and to pray with them, to hold them, that the box of ornaments is a box of memories, perhaps, but they're a box of sacraments, of past fruitfulness, and maybe reminders that you need, just like at the Easter Vigil, we re-up, we re-baptize in a sense. We remember our baptism and we say, "Do you reject Satan?" Yes. And will you do this? Yes, we do believe. Well, putting those ornaments on your tree is a pledge that this is how I want to be. I want to be a fruitfulness of the tree of Christ. I want to be a sacramental place where people see something, some representation of the presence of God. Not the total reality of God, but something. And Jesus says, to have seen me is to have seen enough of the Father that you can understand God a little bit. I come to you according to you, but I don't convince you. I don't want to convince you. As we said last night, as judge, I don't want to convict you. As person who loves you, I don't want to convince you. It's all invitation. It's all invitation. Well, we pray then, and this is just one long thing about this Christmas tree, which becomes a tremendous symbol. Now, you know, yesterday or the day before, they lit up the tree in New York City. 30,000 lights. And people just, oh, it's just wonderful. They had no idea what they were doing. And our cities lights up Christmas tree, and they say, make sure there's nothing Christian about it. See, let's take it away. That the Christmas tree is not a Christmas tree; it's a holiday bush, or a lighting experience. Let's cover it up with so many lights and ornaments that we don't even know it's a tree. No, make sure you have enough tree showing. That you know it's a tree. One time out here, outside of this city where we are, outside of St. Bonifacius, we didn't have great Christmas trees. And as novices, we had the least of all the trees, and it barely had branches and needles. And so one of the more creative brothers had a little sign with an arrow pointing that said, "Tree." Well, anyway, it's the prayer of it, and we'll go to prayer now, is to imagine the tree coming into your house, imagine the rearranging, and imagine how does Jesus rearrange your life, and how are you, not how did you used to be or how do you want to be, but how are you a fruitfulness of the tree. And that's what I'd like us to pray with. Now, one caveat, be careful. I am very aware that when most Christians and Catholics begin to pray, they start with the negative. you're going to start with the bulbs that aren't bright. And you say, that's me. And the ornament that doesn't have a hanger thing on it, or it's cracked, and you say, that's me. No, that's not you. That's you're unconverted. That's the part of the furniture of most that's got to be rearranged. What does God say about you? Start there. Not what you say about you. What you say about you is, in a sense, it's not worth listening to. Because we're Puritans, I am absolutely convinced that the Mayflower landed somewhere on the Mississippi. The Mississippi is this great river in the middle of our country that Puritanism is rampant. Actually, you might know in American history, the Puritans did not allow Christmas. Did not allow the celebration of Christmas in the early part of our country. It was too secular Christian. Well, anyway, start with the lights, the brightness that Christ is in you. That's the only way to pray. I don't think Jesus is real interested in your negative experience of yourself or your opinion of yourself or what you think other people's opinion of yourself. I think Jesus, by giving us ourselves, is saying, this is who you really are. I have come to rearrange your furniture, and the number one piece of furniture that's got to move out is that lazy boy of negativity. That chair's got to go. And it's got so many, you've used it so well and so often that it's broken and doesn't work anymore. I want to give you a new chair, and the new chair is going to be a little uncomfortable because it's new. But what's new is what he says about you and what he said about Zacchaeus and Mary Magdalene and everybody. He went around saying, this is who you are. And we say, no, Jesus, you really don't know me. Well, he came to plant a tree. He came to be the beginning of our fruitfulness. Could we be more fruitful? Yes. Are we not fruitful enough? No, we're not fruitful enough. Enough. That's a bad word. We should throw it out of the English language, at least in prayer books. You're not Christ enough. You're not anything enough, except in the eyes of Jesus.